Buddha, Ruchi Rasmita Sovitani.
E
Partha Herjuna Sakhe Guru Nandaneti. Sanjapitani Naladeva Hiris Prasani.
Struggle in the material world.
intimacy for your heart. Here we see that in the relationship with the Supreme Personality of Godhead, there's no lack of any aspect, whether you are related to Krishna as friend, as parent, as lover. Krishna is the unlimited expert at relationships. Smattur Lutanti Hridaya Mama Madhavasya. Arjuna is saying that when he thinks of the heartiness of the exchanges, how much heart was invested by Krishna and himself in these reciprocal exchanges, he says he's overwhelmed. Now think about that. This is what we would like for ourselves. Intimacy in exchange with such heartiness that we feel overwhelmed. When that happens, you feel the world is actually a decent place, a fulfilling place. If you can have those kind of intimate reciprocations with such heart invested in it. The reality of material existence is that on the material platform, no one can satisfy you. The person trying to satisfy you doesn't have the skills, the capacity, the expertise, and in fact, looking at a deeper level, the person doesn't have the constitutional position or makeup to satisfy it. In other words, by the grand design of the scheme of things, no tiny individual soul can satisfy it. Because we are all just parts. But if we deal with one another through Krishna, then because we're going through Krishna, someone can be satisfied. It is a great lesson to be learned that you can't satisfy anyone on the material platform. You only get the appearance that you're satisfying them or they're being satisfied. Material life means appearances, no substance. But as we explained yesterday, Kali Yuga makes us so desperate that if we just get even the appearance of satisfaction and fulfillment from someone, we think, oh, now I have attained, now I've got it. And isn't this great? If we just get a little sliver, a little shell, with no peanut inside. I got a shell. We just get a shadow and no substance. We're so satisfied. For a moment. But of course, actually, you're not satisfied. You can't be satisfied. Your constitutional nature can only be satisfied in relation to Krishna. How to get this through our heads? There is an illusory energy that's always bewildering us, making presentations that are simply mirages. Do this and you'll be fulfilled. Do this and your heart will be touched. Do this and your heart will rejoice. Isn't there a life there for long though? Then you may say with resignation, well, what else is there to do? Even though I can't be satisfied fully, what am I supposed to do with my life? So I might as well just indulge in serial relationships. One after another, because one cannot satisfy you, but you have to have some intimacy. So you try to juggle your way through material existence. Instead of juggling one or two apples, you juggle 12 apples. Hoping that the more feverishly you juggle, the more you'll generate some kind of fulfillment for yourself. People are facing the facts in the wrong way. They're saying, look, since one person can't satisfy you, then why should we be inhibited by conventional morality? It doesn't work. The human being cannot be satisfied by one person. So just jump from one person to another. Don't try for any steady kind of relationship. It's doomed. Face the facts. We were explaining in New Zealand at our festival how scientists are proposing that, look, here's the reality. The human psychology has not evolved enough to handle long-term relationships. The human psychology is meant for a lifespan of 30 to 35 years. That, a few hundred years ago, supposedly was the average lifespan. You lived until you were 30 or 35, then you died. And so that means if you entered a relationship, as was common then, in your late teens or early 20s, you were basically with that other person just for 11 years, 12 years or so. So in other words, you never had to worry about a long-term relationship because you'd be dead. One of you'd be dead. So the scientists are saying that because the human psychology has not evolved by the so-called laws of evolution beyond the capacity of having a 10 or 11 year relationship, this is why you're seeing so much divorce in society today. Because now people are living until their 70s and 80s. So how do you expect them to spend 50 years with one person? How do you expect them to even spend 15 years with one person? They're not hardwired to do this by evolution. So either we face the facts that it's not going to work. Your quest for fulfillment and intimacy in a long-term relationship is not going to work. In some countries, for example, like the USA, the first marriage, 50%, a little over 50% end in divorce. Second marriage, it goes up to 65% end in divorce. Third marriage, 75% end in divorce. So the scientists, they calculate, look, we can see that actually it is overall beneficial for human beings to be in long-term sustaining relationships. We can see that it's better all around psychologically. But they're not hardwired to do that. So we have a problem. It is better for them to have a satisfying lifelong relationship. But evolution hasn't equipped the human beings with the ability to do that. So what can be done? Science has the answer. You administer to the people appropriate neurochemicals which will stimulate their appetite for the other person. Once again, after that appetite has faded. They're inventing nasal sprays which contain certain neurochemicals. And you just, your relationship is wearing down, it's breaking down, you're arguing, you're tired of each other. The romance is worn off. So all you do is get some of that spray, a particular neurochemical, and all of a sudden, you're in love again. So they're proposing this solution. They're saying that, look, you have to take advantage of what science offers, even though what science offers is not perfected, it's not for sure, but you've got nothing to lose. Look at the statistics. People can't stay together. Even in India, divorce is becoming so widespread. No longer unheard of. Multiple relationships in India, there's nothing unusual anymore. So the scientists are saying, we're going to be for real. We're going to face reality and try to help you with these neurochemicals. Which, because they think anyway, the self is just neurobiology. You're just a bunch of chemicals anyway, so what are you worried about? You are just a bunch of chemicals, and we add some chemicals to you to make you a better chemical combination. So one chemical combination can relate to another chemical combination in a lifelong way. What's the problem? What do you mean? You want intimacy, you want heartiness in a lifelong way. No one wants divorce. No one wants the agony of splitting a relationship, but it's happening. More than it's not happening. So why not take shelter of science to achieve your goals? Now the question is, how would you feel if someone you were in a relationship with took shelter of such neurochemicals in order to preserve the relationship? How would you feel? Perhaps if you were a lady, you would start wondering, well, how do I know if this is really the person I'm dealing with and not just the chemicals? How do I know this is natural? Okay, things are going better. We're not arguing anymore. And he looks at me with a glint in his eye once again. But how do I know it's not just the drugs? And then if you're a guy, what do you think? Hey, whatever works. Don't worry about it. So these are some of the issues that are coming up now. Because, as I'm explaining in New Zealand, these methods are being propagated by top-notch scientists from Oxford and other places. They're saying, look, we got to do something about the human condition. And we have nothing to lose. What do the Bhakti yogis propose? We propose that connection to Krishna is your eternal constitutional position. And unless that connection is revived, you'll never be satisfied and fulfilled in any kind of relationship. Krishna is the expert at friendship, conjugal love, relationship with parents. This is why Krishna's pastimes are so attractive to us. We see what our heart wants. In Krishna's pastimes, everything is perfectly in relation to Krishna. Just like Arjuna. Arjuna so much resembles Krishna in physical appearance that sometimes he's called Krishna. Or else he's called Krishna Sakha. He's the friend of Krishna. The five Pandavas all had the attitude of friendship with Krishna. Draupadi did also. Yudhisthira was older than Krishna, so he had a parental aspect to his friendship relationship with Krishna mixed in. That's why when the five Pandavas would meet Krishna, Yudhisthira would smell Krishna's head because he was older, in a superior position as the monarch. So therefore, once again, Yudhisthira Maharaj's friendship, his sakya ras, was mixed with a little bit of parenthood. And then Arjuna, Bhima, they were equal from the material sin. And Nakula and Sade, they were junior to Krishna. They would fall at his feet and touch his feet. So their friendship was mixed with a little servitorship. Krishna, for those of you who read Nectar of Devotion, you know he has different levels of intimacy and friends. There are four different levels based on confidentiality. Krishna's most intimate friends participate in carrying messages to Krishna's girlfriends, interceding upon Krishna's behalf, or interceding on behalf of the gopis. So Krishna has all kinds of friends. He relishes dealings with those friends more than the official praises of the Rig Veda, official hymns. You can experience this yourself as a tiny part and parcel of Krishna. Let's say someone is praising you officially. At first, you may think this is kind of nice, but actually, you'd rather just have some spontaneous, casual good times with friends than to be officially praised. Social prestige and fame is nice, but it doesn't really touch the core of your heart. Sure, everyone would like to be celebrated throughout society, but after all that is finished, in other words, when your day of social fame has ended, what is your heart longing for? Intimate affairs with true confidential friends and lovers. We have those tendencies because we're part of Krishna. That's why we sing before Bhagavatam class the song Jai Radha Madhava Kunja Vihara Gopi Jana Vallabha Giri Vallabha. You're singing about Krishna's relationships. How is it that we think the Supreme Absolute Truth is impersonal? Sometimes you may have this fear that Krishna is simply mythology, all these leelas, all these reciprocations between Krishna and his devotees. Maybe you sometimes think this is kind of mythological. You think that way because of prejudice. Due to conditioned life, the mind has become predisposed to denying the personhood of the Supreme Absolute Truth. It's a bias implanted in you by contact with the illusory energy. Because otherwise you have no reason to have such a bias. Think about it. At least you should be open-minded and equally disposed. Well, the Supreme Absolute Truth could be impersonal, could be personal. At least be open-minded. But why this attitude that as soon as you hear about Krishna's pastimes with the Pandavas, with the residents of Vrindavan, something in you says, mythology, fables, folk tales, stories about the Hindu love god. What's in you that makes you do that? It's bias, it's prejudice. Because if you're honest, you'll easily admit you'd love to have your own pastimes. You want intimacy, you want heartiness in relationships. So why deny that in the Supreme Absolute Truth? Why would you deny it? It can only be because of envy. Krishna can't have it, but I can have it. This is envy. Krishna is impersonal. His pastimes are just mythology. Or if you want to be an eloquent Mayavadi, you say, Krishna's pastimes are nice constructs, nice devices to increase our meditational focus. But once your meditational powers increase, then you can go beyond Krishna. Of course, just the words beyond Krishna are nonsensical. There's no such thing as beyond Krishna. Just like there's no such thing as horse's eggs. words may know they don't mean anything, and they shouldn't mean anything to you. Don't try to compute. Oh, beyond Krishna. Oh, I wonder what that is. It makes no sense. But materialized means you try to make sense of those words, beyond Krishna. Yeah, yeah, beyond Krishna. There must be the, you know, the all-pervading. Oh, who really knows? So you train yourself that as soon as someone says beyond Krishna, your brain refuses to process. It's like as soon as someone says horse eggs, your brain just, you know, it doesn't work. It's, you don't even think about it. What does Krishna explain in Bhagavad Gita? Mata pratram danya kinchira sti dhananjaya. Oh, Dhananjaya. One who's famous for getting well. There's nothing beyond me. So Krishna in the Gita says there's nothing beyond him. But our conditioned speculations motivate us to try and find something beyond Krishna. It can't be that Krishna and Arjuna living together, sleeping, sitting, and loitering together. Arjuna is playfully reproaching Krishna when there seems to be some apparent discrepancy in their friendly dealings. My dear friend, you are very truthful. That can't be the ultimate. You can just feel your conditioned nature crying out, no, no. What makes us say that and feel that? Envy. Because we want all that for ourselves. Yes, hardiness. Smato natanti hridayam mama adavasya. Hridayam, heart and soul. That's what we want, yes. Whether it's in friendship or a conjugal relationship, this is what you want, heart and soul. And what happens when it's not there? You get angry. Where's your heart and soul now? What happened to it? I was asking some devotees a few days ago. There was a wedding in New Zealand. And so I asked your household devotees, I asked, why do people, especially ladies, get emotional at weddings? Because one, the girl who was getting married, she said, oh, probably my mother's going to cry. I said, why? And then she explained that it won't simply be at her own daughter's wedding that the mother cries, but she cries at every wedding. So I asked, well, do men? It seems men don't cry at weddings, but they told me yes, sometimes it happens. Yeah, you have seen sometimes men cry at weddings. Men? Why? Why is he crying at the wedding? Because there's this deep longing for fulfilling relationships. And the wedding is hope. Yes. It can happen in the material world. Satisfaction can be there, even for just a moment. That's all right, but it's just for a moment. It's worth it just for a moment. I mean, of course, we're speaking materially, not material relationships, and the material aspects of relationships. For devotees who keep Krishna's service in the center, they're not simply relying on their limited capacities, they're relying on Krishna. And hardiness in relationships, when Krishna is in the center, that's something that gets deeper and deeper as time goes by. As you tolerate the material insufficiencies, you tolerate those material imbalances because you have your vision set on a higher goal. How to relate through Krishna's service, for Krishna's service. But anyway, let's go back to people getting emotional at weddings. It just shows you. We're having a wedding here soon. to say the least. You want hardiness. And you're hoping for perfect reciprocation. Krishna does all that. But yet we deny this in the Supreme Absolute Truth. And we are plagued sometimes by doubts that Krishna Leela is just folklore. Once Srila Prabhupada himself said, I wonder how many of my disciples actually accept that Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Or unconsciously, are we just believing in God? Whatever. You don't want to think that you're an atheist. I believe in the Supreme, I believe in God. And perhaps just out of cultural tradition, you say, yes, yes, my grandmother says it's Krishna, so I say it's Krishna also. There are many gods, so, you know, okay. Indra, Shiva, Brahma, Vishnu, Krishna, okay. Krishna, all right, that seems to be working. To actually understand Krishna means to understand he is the perfect reciprocator in loving exchanges. The depths of his perfection in exchanging love, he doesn't even share with Narayan or Vishnu. So again, think what your heart really wants and understand that is what bhakti is all about. We should remember that the mourning that Arjuna is going through is not material mourning, lamentation. His feelings of separation from Krishna are all spiritual, and therefore, as we explained yesterday, his affection for Krishna is increasing throughout these feelings displayed in this chapter. Material life means you're always lamenting about something, and you can never say that your affection is increasing because of that lamentation. Spiritual lamentation means your service to Krishna is increasing, and your affection for Krishna is increasing. Try to analyze your life and see how much struggle you're making and how much adjustments you're trying to make to solve your heart problems. You have hopes for your heart. There are tragedies that your heart goes through. There are temporary delights and exaltations that your heart goes through. We try so many different methods. How to adjust this world so that it will satisfy your heart. Please think about that. Try to see what's pushing you onward. Generally it's easier for ladies to admit this than men. There's a myth that men are not emotional. Not true. It's just buried deeper down inside. But no, men are very emotional. And they want hardiness. They want the perfection of loving exchanges. So they work so hard, not simply for social fame, social respect, and getting money to buy all the male gadgets. They're not simply working hard for that. They're working hard because they hope that when they come home, they'll be their own little world of perfect loving exchanges waiting for them. The little kids will run up, oh, father, father, father. The wife will be 100% sweet. There'll be a huge, on the table will be a of course, the ladies are hoping there'll be a man who knows how the ladies feel even before they feel it. So we have all these hopes at the core of our being, yet we can't recognize that they're there in the Supreme Master of Truth. Only envy blinds our vision in this way. So Srimad Bhagavatam is presenting, right under your nose, the supreme loving activities of the Supreme Absolute Truth. The more you hear about Krishna, the more you become attracted. Hearing reduces that envy. Hearing reduces that aversion you have to Krishna being the supreme enjoyer. Just hearing about Krishna driving the chariot of Arjuna puts a devotee in ecstasy. Lord Chaitanya saw that when he was touring Sri Ranga Kshetra in South India. He saw there's a brahmana known to be illiterate, couldn't read, but yet that illiterate brahmana was sitting in the temple every day reading, trying to read Bhagavad Gita, or at least he was turning the pages. So all the other brahmanas were laughing. You know this path. Oh, this is so foolish. We all know he can't read, yet he's turning the pages pretending to read. Never seen anything so ridiculous. But Lord Chaitanya, as the foremost devotee, could see Krishna Bhakti. So he approached the illiterate brahmana. Why? If you can't read, you're turning the pages. Why the pretense? The apparent pretense. And the illiterate brahmana explained, what can I do? My guru ordered me every day to read Bhagavad Gita. So to follow his order strictly, I turn the pages, I try to pronounce the words even though I don't know what I'm looking at. I'm just trying to follow his order according to my capacity. The Lord Chaitanya pointed out something else. He said, not only are you turning the pages and moving your lips as if you can read, but I notice tears are falling from your eyes. What's happening? So the illiterate brahmana explained that in my following the order of my guru to read Bhagavad Gita, even though I can't read, every time I turn a page, I think of how Krishna, the Supreme Absolute Truth, has taken the subordinate position to his devotee and is driving the chariot of Arjuna. On every page I see that. And I cry. I see Krishna and Arjuna on their chariot on every page that I turn in Bhagavad Gita. And I become overwhelmed by the thought that the Supreme Absolute Truth has become the servant of his devotee. So I'm crying. And what was Lord Chaitanya's judgment? You are the real reader of Bhagavad Gita. You don't know Sanskrit, you can't read, but because you strictly follow the order of your guru, you're actually seeing Krishna's pastimes as part of sarvati. So it's not simply that only Krishna's pastimes in Vrindavan have such emotional impact. Yes, that's the pinnacle, but we shouldn't neglect Krishna on the battlefield of Kurukshetra. Seeing him there, for those who have a relationship or friendship, seeing Krishna on the battlefield of Kurukshetra was a stimulant for ecstatic love and friendship. Nectar devotion explains that. Krishna himself is the stimulant for ecstatic love and friendship. So finally you ask yourself, why a are we so hesitant to approach Krishna if Krishna is the best at relationship reciprocation? That hesitation we have is because of lifetimes of conditioning. In other words, we have developed an artificial aversion to Krishna, which can only be counteracted by devotional service. And that devotional service includes a major dose of hearing and chanting about Krishna. By undergoing that process of devotional service, you naturally become attracted to Krishna again. So the real quest in your life is to revive your dormant attraction for Krishna. That is your real career. As we spiritually progress, we start to feel the disease that's entered our heart. The disease of material enjoyment. I am the enjoyer. Sometimes you can just feel this welling up inside you. I need something to enjoy. I've got to act like I'm the enjoyer. I have to actually shake. Gradually in bhakti, you rediscover your capacity as Krishna's servant. And this addiction to being the enjoyer diminishes. So what if it takes a lifetime? What else are you going to do with your life that's bad? People will spend a whole lifetime making corporate advancement. Why can't we spend a whole lifetime making spiritual advancement? If you start working in your 20s, and then by the time you are 60, you achieve a top level in the corporation, who will criticize you, right? Everyone will say, well done, right? So, all right, so similarly, you start bhakti in your 20s, and by the time you're in your 60s, you can see that your material desires are diminishing, that you're giving up the false attempt to be the enjoyer. So what sane person will criticize?
Why did you spend your whole life just for that?
You won't mind sacrificing to get the top level in material life on the top level of the corporation. That's okay. So what if it takes to your 60? What's wrong with spending your whole life for the most important goal? How to become qualified to have hearty exchanges with Krishna. The more you hear about Krishna, the more confidence you'll have in his ability to arrange loving affairs. Simultaneously, you'll lose your misplaced confidence in the material energy that it can satisfy you. Last night, we were having a nice discussion amongst persons who were approaching bhakti. We're practicing to some degree. And so they asked a very deep question. Okay, water the tree at the root and all the branches will blossom, rather than water each leaf individually. But how do people feel different by your loving Krishna? All right, you're watering the tree at the root. You're putting the food to the stomach. We know that philosophy. They had heard that. But let's say there's a first nobody here, and you're doing your bhakti, loving devotional service to Krishna. How does that first nobody there feel any better? In other words, can another person feel the practical effects of your focusing on Krishna? Well, then we have to start, I explained, understanding what is real Because if you think that love is just a material thing of biology and psychology, then you don't understand what the other person's real identity is. So you'll look for the effects of love of Krishna in terms of biology and psychology, which you're not anyway. So you'll look for the effects of love of Krishna in an illusory way. Part of advancing in bhakti is understanding that you can't satisfy someone materially because they're not material. So therefore, don't look for the effects of loving Krishna on someone's psychology and biology. They're not that. The effects of loving Krishna are felt by the spirit soul. Okay, maybe right now that person next to you can't perceive the effects of love of Krishna. But it doesn't mean that they'll never, ever be able to experience that. Maybe they won't feel it in this lifetime, but there's future lifetimes. So the bhakti yogi is committed to the loving endeavor, not just for a few years, not just for one lifetime. We're committed eternally as Krishna's eternal servants. We're in it for the short range and the long range. It also is a fact that if just a small percentage, Srila Prabhupada would sometimes say, if just 1% of the world's population became Krishna conscious, you would see material changes in nature. You would see material changes in governments, in ordinary social economic dealings. If just 1% of the world's population became Krishna conscious. Those are corollary effects, supplementary effects, they're not the main effect. The main effect of your doing devotional service to Krishna is that your dormant love for Krishna revives. And that means, as your dormant love for Krishna is reviving, those who are fortunate to be around you become inspired to serve Krishna. That is the effect. Even unknowingly, if they assist you, they're making spiritual advancement. That is the effect. And also, we pointed out yesterday that the distribution of bhakti knowledge is love. It's a symptom of the effect loving Krishna has on others. Because people are suffering, because they're suffering due to ignorance. If you give them the knowledge to destroy their ignorance, isn't that love? Isn't that a practical effect of loving Krishna? That the knowledge is going out so that the suffering caused by ignorance in others is destroyed. These are practical effects of love of Krishna in everyone's life. The distribution of bhakti knowledge is not just some kind of social duty that we do. It is actually the symptom of love. It's not that we simply have a religious doctrine like everyone else does. No, this transcendental knowledge is uncontaminated by material motivation. Therefore, it can transform persons at the deepest level. This is why Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, the fire of transcendental knowledge burns. Fire is not theoretical. It's not some kind of beliefy thing. Stick your hand in fire, you get burnt. Add bhakti knowledge to your life, there's transformation. Because that knowledge is devoid of material motivation. Therefore, it's identical with Krishna. These are the practical effects that loving Krishna can have on everyone's life. The more persons commit themselves Krishna, the more you see the transcendental knowledge being distributed. And that transcendental knowledge is identical with Krishna. Bhagavatam, Bhagavad Gita are identical with Krishna. They destroy the ignorance people have. People are only suffering because of ignorance. That's all. So, love means to relieve that ignorance and connect them to Krishna. These are the practical effects of loving Krishna that everyone can experience. So that question was very important for the persons last night. Okay, I'm trying to serve Krishna with loving devotion. How's person X or Y over there going to feel any better? On the material platform, you know how to make person X or Y think they feel better, right? Just go up and give them a big hug. Drag them off to your flat or something. Is that really solving anyone's problems? Is that really making anyone feel better? It's just a temporary illusion of fulfillment. So then we have to come to the conclusion, which is humbling. People don't really know how to help others. That's a hard thing to admit. They don't know how to help others. They don't know how to benefit others. Their concept of helping others is simply all about the moment. Make someone physically and psychologically feel better for the moment. Then your job is done. You can't do anything better than that in this world. Beyond that, you'll have to rely on the scientists to give you some neurochemicals. So finally, we need to be convinced about these points, because otherwise we'll have doubts. What are the practical effects on my life and others' life when we love Krishna, when we render devotional service to Krishna? Is this just some kind of religious philosophy, religious theology, spiritual doctrine? Or are there actually practical effects? Which, as the greatest devotees say, these practical effects are the greatest benefit for all living entities. How can that be so? How can it be the greatest benefit for me, first of all? You have to address that point. So please think how it is that loving Krishna through loving devotional service is the most practical way to love all living entities. Alright, any questions? Yes. Indicating that you are free and independent. When the mode of passion strikes, Jane. But you see, I'm independent. I chose Jill instead of Jane. No, you're under the gun of
Rajaguna.
This is why understanding Bhagavad-gita is so important. You realize you're chained. The gunas, they mean qualities. They also mean ropes that bind you. One example I give, there's a true story. There's a waterfalls in New Zealand called the Huka Falls. Anyone ever seen the Huka Falls in New Zealand? Yes. So, before you get to the waterfall, there's a river. And then the river narrows into a very narrow channel for about a half a kilometer. And then it hits the waterfalls. So one man decided to ride a canoe over the waterfalls. So he started in the river. And he was a professional. He's looking good with his canoe, you know. And then he got to the narrow channel of water leading to the falls. And he was looking very expert then, going so fast and so smooth. And then, in full view of busloads of Japanese tourists, he went over the waterfalls. And, of course, when he was at the bottom of the waterfalls, he was thrown out of his boat, and he was struggling. And so, what would you say about his struggling? This is independence, right? Just see how he's struggling. Just see how he's coughing up water. Just see his individuality. Look at the swimming togs he's wearing. The latest fashion. He's kept his head above the water for 30 seconds, a new world record. Is that what you focus on? What is the actual reality? The actual reality is going to drown. Everybody on shore knew he had no hope. He was so crazy, he just wanted to demonstrate his stylistics before he drowned. There's no way he could survive at the base of the waterfall, all that water thundering down. But material life means we would just focus on his stylistics and his individuality. Never mind, he's going to drown. Look at the way he's spitting up water. Never mind, he's going to drown. What color swimming clothes is he wearing? Latest Speedos? Oh, what's his nationality, I wonder? Look at the way he's flailing his arms in a way never done before. How unique. How individual. It's all meaningless. What is the overall reality? He's drowning. And he did, in full view of busloads of tourists. So, I use that example to explain to people why you're making such a big deal out of these tiny little stylistics and expressions of individuality when there's a huge reality swallowing you up. You're declaring your independence based on these tiny mannerisms of a drowning man. It is foolish and tragic. Can you see, just like the waterfall had this man in its grip, can you see how material nature has you in your grip? If you could see that, you wouldn't pay attention to all these minor stylistics and say, just see my independence, I chose Jill instead of Jane. We elected this, we put this party in office. Not that party. Democracy. You get to choose between ignorant person A, ignorant person B, or ignorant political party A, ignorant political party B. Just see your independence.